Now, secondly, what the spiritual community is not. I've decided to put that next before even trying to say what the spiritual community is, because there are so many misunderstandings on the subject, and it's perhaps even more important to get the misunderstandings out of the way than to have a right understanding. And in any case, a right understanding isn't possible until those misunderstandings have been removed. Now, let me, as it were, say the most important thing first. Say as briefly and also as bluntly as possible, say that in the first place, the spiritual community is not a group. The spiritual community is not a group. Now, this may appear to contradict what I said at the beginning of the lecture. At the beginning of the lecture, I spoke of Buddhist groups. I envisaged someone going along to a Buddhist group or belonging to a Buddhist group. But at that time, I was using the expression group rather loosely. It's now time for us to be rather more precise. And in any case, one can also say, and this is perhaps a salutary reminder, one can also say that in any case, even a Buddhist group is not necessarily the same thing as a spiritual community. Now, if a spiritual community is not a group, then a question arises. The question is, what is the difference between the two? Wherein does a spiritual community differ from a group? Wherein does a group differ from a spiritual community? And this difference too can be very briefly and bluntly stated. And we can say that a spiritual community consists of individuals. Bearing in mind what I said about individuality in lecture number 3. A spiritual community consists of individuals. This, of course, suggests that a group does not consist of individuals. And this is in fact the case. In a group, we may say, individuality either does not exist at all, or it tends to be submerged, or at least held very much in abeyance. Now, groups, as we all know, are of very many kinds. Some are large, some are small. Into some groups we are born. Others we have to join, either by paying a subscription or being initiated or being drafted, and so on. So let's take a look at a few of these groups, a few kinds of groups. Well, first and foremost comes, of course, the family. Then comes the tribe. Then we have the race. These are all groups. They're not spiritual communities. We have the caste, especially in India. On a rather larger scale, we've got the nation. We've also got the church and the sect. Then there's the clan. And again, there's the class. And again, there's the conventicle, and there's the party, there's the union, again, the association. Then there's the linguistic group, for which we don't have any separate term for some reason or other. Then again, there's the regiment, the force, and again, the fraternity, and again, the firm. We've got all these sorts of groups. And many of these groups we know have got their own distinctive symbols. You see the symbol and at once you think of that particular group owning the symbol. For instance, there's the totem pole. Then there's the national flag. Then again, there's the national anthem. And even, in some places, the national dress. There's also the old school tie. And then again, the fraternity pin. And of course, there's the union ticket, the union card, and there's the party badge. And all these symbols of groups of one kind or another, have got enormous emotive value and emotive power. Well, people will die for these things, as we know. They'll kill for these things. Not only that, not only do we have symbols of this sort, group symbols of this sort, but we've got various expressions, even various slogans, expressive of group loyalties. We've got, for instance, expressions like God's own country, home sweet home, land of hope and glory, the old firm, church and state, the empire on which the sun never sets, Deutschland über alles, Heil Hitler, keep the country white, don't let the side down, workers of the world unite, make love, not war. These are all slogans, expressions, expressive of group loyalties of one kind and another, and they all have a such very strong emotive value, tremendous emotive value. In fact, we may say, quite categorically, that group feelings go very, very deep indeed. There's hardly anybody who isn't involved in, who isn't a member of one group or another, sometimes many groups indeed, and who doesn't feel very, very loyal to them. That loyalty may not always be expressed, it may not always be conscious, but it's there, deep down. And if sometimes your group loyalties are offended, then from being a very decent, innocent, lamb-like sort of citizen, you become either a roaring tiger or a raging wolf, ready to devour whoever crosses your path and challenges your particular group or questions your particular group loyalty. So deep do group loyalties run, so strong are the feelings involved, so ubiquitous, so invariable, so universally distributed amongst human beings, that some people, some anthropologists and psychologists, even go so far as to speak of a group instinct. In the same way that we've got a reproductive instinct and so on, we've got also a group instinct, which impels us, you know, just like those lemmings rushing into the sea, impels us just to get together and be with other people and so on. Now, there may or there may not be any such thing as a group instinct. The whole question of instinct is nowadays very much under discussion. And some psychologists have gone so far as to deny that there are any such things as instincts at all, and to say that the word instinct is completely misleading, a sort of red herring dragged across the path of psychological science, and just doesn't correspond to anything at all, and it better be dropped. But whether that is so or not, whether there are instincts or aren't instincts, one can certainly say that groups, group formations, are encountered not only on the human, but also on the animal level. Animals form groups as well as human beings. And animal groups seem to fulfill a very definite biological function. The group provides warmth. If it's bitterly cold and you're in danger of being frozen to death, well, you will huddle together and you keep warm through the winter. The poor animal can't kindle a fire. Even sometimes his woolly coat isn't enough. So what does he do? He huddles together with other members of the same species. And they also provide him with shelter. The larger animals shelter the younger ones. Also provide him with safety. Even the lion might hesitate to attack a large herd of cattle. And in this way, the group, on the animal level, facilitates the survival of the species concerned. And we can say
that animal groups and human groups have very much in common. They're similar in very many ways. Both, of course, belong to the lower evolution. Both are collective. Right? Both have a sort of collective mentality. You know that when you go into a big group, maybe when you go to watch a football match or something of that sort, or maybe when you join the army or you're conscripted and you have to go away and fight, you find, as it were, the group spirit, the group mind, almost the group soul, sort of takes over. You become submerged in the group. There's a sort of collective spirit or group soul, as it were, that controls you and that you obey. This isn't just sort of occult mythology. This is much more like psychological fact.